Dixie. We've got a slightly unusual event today. We're being taped, and basically we'll just pretend they're not here, which was their request. Before we get going with the selection sort again, are there any questions about anything? Okay. Well, what I'd like to do first is review the algorithm. We did go through it yesterday, but I think this is tough enough to understand that we probably ought to go through it quicker this time, but go through it again. And then when we look at the code, I think it'll be easier to understand if we've just looked at these graphics again to see how the sort works. So first of all, the idea was to take this array, those five elements, and of course put it in ascending numeric order, and that would give us this array over here. One thing that I didn't mention yesterday is that this sort is called an in-place sort because it sorts the array, changes the contents of the actual array. It's also possible to do a sort where you make a second copy, keep the original, and then put a sorted array in a second data structure. So that's not what we're doing. We're actually doing the sort inside the array. And let's actually go through this algorithm again. We said there were n minus 1 passes. Here n is 5, so we'll do 4 passes. And we said each one essentially takes us through the array elements one time. We look at them all. We take the item that's in the starting position for the current pass, and we exchange that or swap it with the smallest item that's in the unsorted part for the current pass. So essentially the idea is on one pass to sort one item, and we know from yesterday's fairly quick discussion that after 4 passes, 5 elements would be sorted. And that's always the case, always n minus 1. It's worth noting at this point, actually, that this sort is not the most efficient sort in the world. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. But if you think about it, this sort does exactly the same process even if the whole array is in order to begin with. It always does n minus 1 passes. It's not very intelligent. It doesn't look to see if perhaps something could be done quicker than that. Okay, so we keep doing this. And let's take a look again at these diagrams. So this is our starting point. Initially, the whole array is not sorted. That's the assumption. And the starting point would be the 32. That's the index of 0. And we know that on the first pass, we took that element and we exchanged it with the smallest item that's in the entire array. So the 32 and the minus 16 get swapped. So in the array, they have to trade places. And then what we have after that is this contents in the array, where the minus 16 is in the right spot, and the other items are still considered unsorted. So we've got one item that got sorted on the first pass. Now, this is our starting point for the second pass. So let's take a look at that. Okay, the other thing I've done here, the gray elements are intended to show you what is already sorted, and those are items we're not considering anymore. So just like in the binary search where we eliminated parts of the array from further consideration, we're doing that with this sort also. So the minus 16 at a sub 0 is no longer being looked at. That means the starting point has an index of 1. That's the 115. And then we take the smallest item in that part of the array, so the currently unsorted part, that would be the 32, of course, and then we swap those. So again, those trade places in the array, and we can see that after the second pass, 2 items are sorted. So on the first pass, we sorted 1 item, and on the second pass, we sorted the second item. Now that means that the unsorted part, again, is shrinking, and now I've got 3 items that I have to sort at that point. Okay, so let's look at the third pass. Of course, that's this one. This is where we were after the second pass with the top 2 items sorted. And then we do the same process again. It's really exactly the same process every time. It's just that the part of the array that we're looking at is shrinking. So the starting point now has an index of 2. And that's the 56 here. And then we can see that the smallest item in that part of the array is the 43. And of course, we swap those, and then we end up with this array contents over here. So on the third pass, the third item lands in the correct spot. Now the fourth pass is the last one. We've only got two items left, and you know from common sense, if you've got two things and you sort them, both of them will be in the correct order. So we don't do five passes here, we do four, because that will take care of it. And the starting point now is at index 3, and that's the 115. The 56 obviously is smaller than that, so again we do a swap, and then we end up with the correctly sorted array. So at this point, we're done. N minus 1 passes, and that's it. Now, the next thing we're going to look at is the actual C++ code for it. And hopefully everybody can keep in mind the process behind this. It might be worth, while you're studying for the final, to work through this by hand and just go through the algorithm yourself with a piece of paper. And then compare that with the actual C++ code and make sure you can make the connection between the two. Now, a couple things before we actually look at it. I kept mentioning the starting point. And we'll have one index called start, and that'll be the index to the first item that's in the unsorted part of the array. So start has to range from 0 up through 3. And of course, that's 0 up through n minus 2, if we use n as a reference point. Now, we also need a couple of other indexes. One of them will be called current. And current will range from the index that's right after the starting index, so start plus 1. And that will sequentially go through the array looking for the smallest item. And if you think way back when we talked about finding maximum and minimum, we used a while loop for that early part of the semester. Essentially, what we did was we held the smallest value, the one we currently thought was the smallest, in a special place in a variable. And then as we looked at each other element in the data set sequentially, we compared it to see if it was smaller than the currently smallest item. And if it was smaller, we replaced what we thought was the smallest value. Now, the same algorithm is actually being used here. The difference is that we use array indexes, and what we do is store the index of the smallest item, and if we find a new smallest item, we replace the index that we're saving. So instead of saving the actual smallest value, we save the index to it. Now actually, before we leave this, that actually points out the fact that we need a third index for the smallest item. So three indexes. And actually, let's jump into the code here. Okay, so here's the function. Just like the search routines, if you do write a sort, and program 6 does require a sort, it is best to put it off in its own function. Again, a sort is really a task unto itself, just like a search. And to make your program modular, this really belongs in a function all by itself. So what we do up here is pass in the size of the array, and n is the assumption here. N was 5 in our example that we just did. And then we're just calling this array A. It's a generic name, just an array of ints. Now, once we get into the local declarations, that's where we start seeing the items from the algorithm we just talked about. We've got start, small, and current. And as I mentioned, start is the index to the first element in the unsorted part. Small is going to be the index to the smallest value in the unsorted part. And what we do on a pass is exchange A sub start with A sub small. So that's how we trade these. We know the indexes where they're located. This other one, current, you can think of that as being kind of like a search index. In a way, this looking for the smallest is kind of like a linear search. We're sequentially going through the array. We're looking at each item in turn to see if it's a new small value. And current is the index that takes care of that. Now, these three are all ints. And the important point here is that they are ints because that's the index type of the array. So the type of the subscripts is int. This fourth one here is an int, but when you write another sort, like you write the one for program 6, this fourth variable probably won't be an int. What this needs to be is the type of the elements that are in the array. So if you've got an array of, say, title strings, the type here would be a title string. Or if you've got an array of floats, this would have to be a float. The indexes would still be ints, because we know that array indexes actually have to be ints in C++. Okay, so this last one isn't int because that's actually the base type of the array. And what we'll see is that we'll use this when we make the exchange, because we need actually an extra variable to make a swap. Okay, are there any questions so far about any of this? Yeah, Meredith?
Mm-hmm. So it's just the maximum number you can have.
Actually, that's a really good point. The selection sort always does n minus 1 passes, even if it doesn't need to.
Even if they're already in order?
Yeah, even if they're already in order.
It just doesn't switch on.
Yeah, it doesn't. There's no way to exit this algorithm because the list is sorted. Have you seen the bubble sort before? Perhaps, because I'm wondering if maybe you're thinking that one. That's a sort where once the list is sorted, actually you can exit the algorithm. Oddly enough, it's less efficient than this one, which is why we cover this one in class. Did anyone see that in high school or somewhere else, bubble sort? Okay. Oh, Jim saw it. Very good. I saw it. Okay, well, let's look at this algorithm. And related to your question, Meredith, you can see that there's a for loop controlling this. And what we know about for loops is that style-wise, they should be used to just do straightforward counting. This one counts from 0 up through n minus 2. And in our example case, that would be 0 through 3. And then it stops. So the sort is totally controlled by a counter. There are other sorts where you might have a flag that tells you at some point that the list is actually sorted and now you can exit, but not with this one. Okay, so this is a very predictable, methodical approach to sorting values. Now I should say, rather than to totally denigrate this thing, for small lists, this is perfectly fine. And when you run this, say for program 6, it's a very reasonable sort. It's not such a terrible, inefficient routine that we never use it. For small n, just like the linear search, it's really pretty decent. Okay, well, with that in mind, let's take a look at the code. The for loop, that controls one pass. Basically, one execution of the for loop is one pass. And we know we've got four passes for that little array we just looked at. We start off with start equals 0. That's the first array element. And then what we do with small is, just like what we did before with maximum and minimum, we set small to the first value. Jim, did you have some?
Should that be n minus 2?
No, because it's less than. Good question, Jim. You're totally totally wrong, but that's a good question. Jim asked, should this be n minus 2? And the answer is no, because if we had less than or equal to, we could use n minus 2. But I tried to make this consistent with our other array accessing and put less than. And that means that we'd use n minus 1, and then the loop will range from 0 to n minus 2. So good point. Actually, that's a good review of array indexing for us. So, and again, the reason I did that was to make it consistent with all of our other loops where we went from 0 up to something and we always said less than, and then say the size of the array. Okay, Well, we initialize small to the starting value, and again, we're storing the index of the starting value. We're not really storing the value itself. The value's in the array, so we have that. But we're using the index to keep track of where the smallest item is. Now, this next loop, very short for loop, that's where the search for the smallest item takes place. And we don't need much code to do this. Okay, in this one, current is the index. And remember, current goes from start plus one, so the element after the starting element for this particular pass, and then it ranges up through n minus one. And we know n minus one is the very last array element. So for this one, we're going to start at the element right after the starting point element and go all the way to the end of the array. And we'll look at each one. At each point, we'd say, okay, is A sub current, the one I'm currently looking at, is that less than A sub small? Where small is where we save the index of the currently smallest item, the one we think is the smallest. Now, if it is, we replace small with current. So going back to when we found a minimum in a data set, we'd basically say something, if this is a new low, then replace low with whatever the current value is. And the same thing's happening here, except this is an array index, and so is this one. But they represent the values that we're looking at in the array. Now, when we exit this loop, small would have the index to the smallest item that is in the unsorted part. And that means we're all set to do the last phase here. Okay, so the last part of the pass. And that is to actually make the exchange itself. Now, two words are used for this. One is exchange and the other is swap. And you hear both of those quite frequently. The idea with this one is that, first of all, we check to see if the starting point element is the smallest. Because if that is the smallest, we don't need to make an exchange, and we really ought to skip this three-line sequence here that does the actual swap. So first of all, we'll check if small is not equal to start. And again, the reason for that is that the item that I'm trying to sort might actually already be in the right spot. Okay, let's say it isn't, though, and small is different from start. That would have occurred with every single instance of small in our example that we did with the five array elements. That means we do need to do an exchange, and a swap or an exchange always takes three lines. This is a very predictable process. Three lines, always the same, that you can plug in any program whenever you need to do a swap like this. So first of all, we'll take the starting point element and store that in temp. And remember, temp, we need to essentially hold one of the values so that we can do the exchange. That's all it's functioning as here. And once we've got A sub start stored away in temp, then we can replace it with the small value. So that moves the smallest value to the right spot in the array. And then the other thing we do here is reset A sub small. This is getting A sub start for this last line. Okay, so in effect, this is like saying A sub small equals A sub start. Now, once we've done that, we've done the swap. And actually, let's use the board here for a minute. Okay, it's pretty clear we're doing something like this to trade the two elements. And I've got one question for you, which is, why can't I do this? that in two statements. It looks shorter. I don't have to declare x a variable. Yeah, David?
You'd lose the value to start.
Yeah, exactly. You can't do a swap in two statements because you lose one of the values. You can try, if you're not convinced, tracing through it, and you'll see that one of the values gets lost. They're both equal to the same thing. Let's say that this is 3 and 5. What would happen is that a sub start would get set to 5, and then a sub small is already 5, but you're copying a 5 into it. It's pretty much a useless sequence of code. You just wiped out one of the values. So that's why we need a third variable to actually do this process anytime we want to do an exchange like that. Okay, well, that's the end of the loop that does a pass. And you can see there are basically two processes going on here. The first small for loop, okay, this one, where we look for the smallest item. And then the second part here is this part where we do the exchange. So we do that 4 times, and then as we saw with that small array, at the end of that, we're all sorted. Now, one thing to notice is that if you trace through this code with, as Meredith said, an array that's already all in order, basically you go through the whole thing anyway. So efficiency is not our crowning glory here with this sort. But as I mentioned, it is pretty decent for small n. Did you have a question? Are you talking about destroying the original data?
Yeah.
That you had?
Like
if you read a bunch of data in from a file and then did this in the program, you'd be altering the array in memory only. But then if you were really using a file, what you'd probably do is write out the array to the file at the end. And then, yeah, you would ruin the file, basically. Okay, so it's definitely possible to lose a lot of information with just a tiny little bug like this. Okay, any other questions about the sort here? Okay, well, I think it's kind of amazing. The first time I saw it, which was, I think, 1974, I thought, my goodness, this works. And I want to also mention, if we wanted to sort the array into descending order, all we have to do is change this to a greater than. Now, that's also kind of amazing. Everything would work if we just flipped the sign from less than to greater than. Now, the other thing we would probably do if we did want to sort in descending order is change the name of small, because if we are sorting descending order, the meaning of that index is that it indexes the largest item in the unsorted part of the array. So on program 6, actually, you have to do a descending order sort of numbers. And keep in mind that it's definitely, style-wise, better to rename that one variable. So change it to something like large or largest or max or whatever. Now, we need to talk about efficiency in a little more detail. And there are two things that go into this discussion. One is, how many comparisons? This is a comparison of array elements. We said that with searches, that was really the main thing. How many comparisons do we do? And with the linear search, we saw that we did quite a few. With the binary search, we did a smaller number, typically. With a sort, we've also got another thing going on, and that's how many exchanges are there. So when you talk about efficiency with sorts, it's comparisons and exchanges, typically. Now, again, we won't go into the mathematics behind this. Some of the math majors, I don't know if they wish we would or hope that we never do, but basically that's a topic of other classes, especially EECS 380. If anybody gets to that point, they spend a lot of time on efficiency and The mathematics behind all of this stuff I'm basically giving you up here as just facts. It's all been proven, and that's why I can do that. But later on, if you go on in computer science, you'll see how to prove it. Now, the maximum number of comparisons is given by this formula, n times n minus 1 over 2. One thing that's actually intuitive is the maximum number of exchanges. Now, with that, we can look at this number n minus 1 and say, well, that's the number of passes. I can only do one exchange on a pass, so definitely that is the maximum number of exchanges we could possibly do. So we could do anywhere from 0 up to n minus 1 exchanges. The other number is a bit less intuitive, but one way to think about that is that you've got two loops, two for loops, and they're both ranging to about n. And one thing we saw with nested for loops is that if you have a statement inside the inner loop, it'll execute the number of times that the outer loop executes multiplied by the number of times that the inner loop executes. So actually, what we've got here is basically that situation. All right. For one thing, we did the multiplication example a while ago, where we were multiplying all the numbers from 1 through 9, and we made a nice table. And each loop went from 1 through 9. We said that the statements inside the inner loop executed 81 times, so 9 times 9. And we've got a pretty similar situation right here. Now, with that in mind, actually, when we talk about the time required to execute the algorithm, we look at the most overriding factor, and that is actually the number of comparisons. And that's proportional to n squared. We can see that with this formula here, we've got n times n minus 1, and that's where the n squared comes in. Now, this could get pretty bad. If you're, say, at an airline and you want to sort all of your 5,000 flights, we've got 5,000 squared on our hands, and that's going to be a pretty big number. So this is not an efficient sort for large n. It's called a quadratic sort because I'm sure everybody's seen the quadratic equation, and you know that the idea there is that you've got a square as one of the elements in the equation. And that's what we've got here. We've got n squared. Now, the problem that we've got in a 100-level class is that we can't cover a quick sort. And actually, the quick sort is the name of one of the very efficient sorts. And it uses recursion very heavily in order to perform the process. And it works much better than this particular sort. The problem is that we can't cover that in this course. Okay, we don't cover recursion. We're not going to. If you do go on and, say, take 280, you'd see that pretty early in the course, and then you'd be able to look at the faster sorts at that point. Now, last time we looked at some graphs, the linear search versus the binary search. The linear search was O of n, and the binary search was O of log 2 of n, and we just said, well, this one is O n squared, and the graph for that is approximately like this. Now, I drew this by hand because I was having trouble getting my graphing calculator to allow me to take the image it produced for the graph and then put it in the PowerPoint show. But hopefully this is a good enough approximation that you can see how the processing time increases. And it increases drastically. I mean, this is just really a huge increase as n goes up. Okay. Well, are there any questions at all about the selection sort, or about sorting in general, for that matter? Okay, well, there are lots of other sorts, and if this intrigues you, you could ask Jim or me in office hours about, what else is out there, and we'd be happy to talk about it. One last note about this sort. And that is that in program 6, you need to sort parallel arrays if you use that data structure. You've also got a choice in that program of using an array of structs. And that's something we'll be talking about later, probably not today, probably tomorrow. Now, let's say we had our area codes and our locations array that we talked about yesterday. And what we'd like to do is sort both of them into ascending numeric order by area code. Now, what we know is we can't sort one array and then leave the other one unchanged, because we'll lose that parallel relationship that we worked so hard to set up. So what we need to do with this is do the comparisons using the area codes array. And the area code here would be called the sort key. That means, what are you sorting on? One thing to notice if you use Excel is that you can sort the data that you're looking at. And you'll actually see the word key in one of their windows with the options that you're picking for the sort. So you can choose what to sort on, and that's what you're actually looking at. So for a comparison, I'd have this. If area code subcurrent is less than area code subsmall, and that would take care of that part of the selection sort as far as converting it over to this other array. Obviously, I'd need to pass in the area codes array itself, and I'd need to pass in the size of the area codes array. Other than that, I could basically take the selection sort, copy and paste it into this new program that I'd be working on, and just substitute the word area codes and replace, you see, array A that we were just looking at. Now, there's another issue, and that is, well, what about the exchanges? And this is where parallel arrays get to be a little bit awkward. If you've got two arrays, it's not really too bad. But if you had three or four or five parallel arrays, this could get to be very inconvenient, because you can compare in one array, but you have to exchange in all the parallel arrays. So you have to do the same exchange with the same indexes in both arrays at the same time. And what we just saw was that an exchange takes three lines. So this would take six lines to exchange area code substart with the smallest item, and then location substart with the same index item in the locations array. So again, for program six, you've got to do a sort. And if you choose to use parallel arrays, this is basically what you have to go through in order to do it. It doesn't change the selection sort a whole lot. You just need to plug in the extra code to do the exchange in the other array. Okay, well, are there any questions about this? Okay, well, let's start looking at structs. Okay, so we're taking a drastic turn of topics here away from arrays, and we'll start talking about this new data structure. The struct is extremely important in programming, so is the array, but with the struct, actually, we open up a whole new group of possibilities in programming. Most dynamic data structures are set up with structs. If you look at object-oriented programming, the basic unit there is called the class. And the class is essentially something that derived from structs. So once you understand structs, you're getting a long way toward learning some more advanced programming techniques. Now, an array, we said, was a list. We talked about the idea of abstract data types, and we said that people frequently use the word list of something. And an array very naturally fits that description. A struct really fits a record. Now, people don't use that term quite as much, but you do hear things like a patient record or a student record. If you go into the registrar, you might want to find out something about your student record, for example. And the struct is a very natural data structure for representing that sort of information. Now, with a student record, you'd expect quite a lot of information. It wouldn't all be the same data type. We'd have names, addresses, phone numbers, we'd have grades, GPAs for every semester, cumulative GPAs. Basically, you know what you see when you look at Wolverine Access. Now, on the other hand, an array, we said, has a list of things. They're all the same type. And now, all of a sudden, we're talking about storing lots of information that's all different types. So we need something a little more complicated than the array to actually set this up and do it in an appropriate fashion. So first of all, let's look at the similarities and differences here. Okay, they're both data structures. They're both what the book calls composite data types, or structured is another word for that, meaning that I've got a group of elements. Now, with the array, we said we have to fix the size. And that's true of the struct also. We've got a maximum number of elements. When we declare the struct type, we establish that, and it is set for the rest of the program. With the array, now we get into the differences here. All the elements have to be the same type. So I could have a list of ints or a list of strings, but I can't have a list of ints and strings. Okay, for that, I could actually set up an array of structs, and then I could have a list of mixed types, but I'd have to use both of these data structures to set that up. Arrays by themselves wouldn't do it. Now, clearly, this is a big advantage. Elements can be different types in structs. So that's where we can do the combination of all these different types of data. Okay, another item that we talked about with arrays is that we can access any element at any time using the index. We've got direct access to the elements that way. And they're all numbered and they're in order. The order never changes. Okay, at least the order of the basic array structure. So indexes ranging from 0 up to and then n minus 1. Once we define the array, we can't alter that. Now, with structs, we don't have this same structure. We don't have indexes, we don't have numbers, and we'll access these things in a very different way. We'll access the elements in a struct, and they're called members, with this new operator, basically you type a period on the keyboard, and you get the member operator, and then we'll use the name. So with arrays, we use a subscript and an index, a numeric value, and with structs we use the dot and then the name of the element in the struct that we set up. Okay, so let's look at some examples here. And we'll go back to Merlin. And we'll imagine that we're writing a small version of Merlin. Okay, so we're going to set up a book struct, a book record, and we'll put a few of the major items in it so that we can look at how we could set that up in a real program. So first of all of this would be global. We said that type definitions typically are put in a global position in the program. And of course, that's so the rest of the program can access the type. And we also know that we can't cause bugs in a program by declaring constants and types globally. So we would put this at the beginning of the program in front of main. And first of all, I'll set up a constant for the string size. And we're going to have actually authors and titles in the book struct. So I'm allowing 41 characters for each one of those. And of course, the one is for the null character. So 40 characters in a title or 40 in the author's name. That sounds like enough to avoid any kind of problems with input and range errors. Now, the type for the string here is actually, of course, this type def. Name string is the generic name that I'll use for both the authors and the titles. And then we use the constant there, of course, to set up the size. So we've established the information that we need to declare the book record. And actually, the definition of the book record starts here at the word struct. And then you can see it has braces enclosing the body of the structure. And what I'm defining inside is the members. So this struct has four members in it. They're the title, the author, the number of copies of the book, and then all taken out. So the title and the author are pretty obvious what they are. The number of copies is how many does the library own. And then all taken out would represent the obvious also. Are they all taken out, or is there something available that you can get a copy of? Now, if you just look at this, if you take off these braces here, this looks just like variable declarations that we've done earlier in the course. The difference being that they're inside a struct. So I have two strings, an int and a bool, and they're being put together here as a unit in a data structure that contains all four of them. So as far as the syntax for writing the interior here, you just use what you're accustomed to for declaring variables. And then keep in mind that these are all components in this overall data type. Now, one thing to notice here is these are not variable declarations. Okay, actually, I haven't declared any variables yet. This is a type definition. So they look like variable declarations, but they aren't. Okay, what we'll do on the next slide here is actually set up the variables. And we're going to start off here with just declaring a couple of book records, book one and book two. And you can see that I use the type book rec, just like other types that we've used in the past. And then book one and book two are the two variables that we're declaring. Now, that's when space gets allocated to store a variable. Remember, the data type definition doesn't cause memory allocation. Okay, all it does is set up a pattern for variables that when you declare them, you can use the data type. But the variable declaration, that's when we actually get some storage space and we can store some data in. So now I've got two books. And what I've done here is just written assignment statements to put data in all four members of book one. Now, the title and the author are strings. So what we saw very recently is that we need to use string copy. And what we're doing here is putting the title Walden into the title field. By the way, field is another term that's used for member. And I may use both of those in class. And what we're doing here is putting Henry Thoreau. David didn't fit on the slide, so I didn't put that in there. But putting his name in the author field here. And then the library has two copies, so we can assign that into the numCopies field. And then what we're saying here is that they aren't all taken out at the moment, so we'll set this to false. Now, as far as the notation here, let's look at this last one. The thing to notice is that the very first item is the name of a struct variable. So book one is the name of the variable that I declared up here as book rec. And then the dot here in this spot, that's the member operator. And then if you look at the word all taken out, that is from the type definition. So we've got something a little new here as far as the syntax, where this is a variable name, and this is something from a type. Okay, we're not really used to doing things like that. Now, one difficulty that we see in this class with programs where we've got structs is a little confusion over the notation, and that's why I'm emphasizing it. Okay, are there any questions about this so far? Yeah? Well, that's a really good question. You're thinking ahead here. If you really were writing Merlin, you wouldn't declare book one, book two, book three, book four. I mean, we'd be sitting there typing all day long. What we'll talk about after our initial discussion of just single structs here is how to set up an array of structs. Because, of course, the library is not going to have one book or three or whatever. It's going to have lots and lots and lots. So One possible data structure is to declare this book record and then declare an array of book records. That's the other possible data structure you can use on program 6 if you would like to. Actually, you've got a choice, either parallel arrays or an array of structs. So that's a good point. We're going to get to that, not today, obviously, but we'll probably be talking about that tomorrow. Okay, well, let's try to think about how, in memory, we might picture this as being stored. When we talked about arrays, we drew them like this, where they had sequential elements. They were all the same size, because they're all exactly the same data type. Now, with a struct, it appears that we could use something similar to imagine how it's stored, but they're not all the same size. So I've tried to represent that here. The strings we know are 41 characters. So in reality, we'd have 41 bytes of storage for each one of those. We actually know that these are arrays. In fact, we could draw this a little differently. The title here is a string, and so is the author. And we could have drawn it up there very similarly, but said, okay, well, that's an array. It's got 41 elements in it. Each one's got its own little box. So actually, it's a little more complicated than we've got up here. What we're doing with this is basically taking a fairly high-level look at it, at the whole thing, and not looking at the individual characters in the strings just yet. Now, the true and the false would be stored in a lot less storage space. What we saw with ints is that they get 32 bits. And booleans we actually haven't talked about, but they can be stored typically in one byte. So we'd have a large group of sequential storage locations, which is like an array. These are stored consecutively in memory. The difference being that they're not uniform storage locations. We've got items of different sizes because they're different data types. So we could picture book one like this, and I think it's helpful to think about it this way so that when you work with structs in a program, you've got something to kind of pin it on as far as what it looks like. Okay, well, let's take a look at a couple of issues before we have to stop. We just set up book one and we initialized it. All four members have values. And if I wanted to copy all of book one into book two, one very convenient thing about structs is that I can do that with an assignment statement. So if I write book two equals book one, that does the whole thing. It copies the two strings and the int and the bool. Now, that may be a little surprising based on what we talked about with arrays. And just to compare the two for the moment, is it possible to write something like this? Okay, I've got two arrays of ints with 10 ints each, and I've initialized B, just like I initialized book one. B would have all zeros in it because of that. And then, can I write A equals B? I just wrote book two equals book one, but can I actually do that? No, Polly, why not?
You can just you can do that in initialization, like A equals 10, but that you assignment.
Yeah, you can't use assignment with arrays except when you declare them and you initialize them. That's what Polly was saying. So no, I can't do that. Even though it looks like an analogous operation, it's not possible. What could I do instead? Let's say I did want to copy all of B into A. What would I be able to do in C++ that would work? volunteers? Well, it is 10 o'clock. So I'll just quickly say here that to do this, we could write a little for loop that went from 0 up through 9, and then brute force method, copy every single element of B into the corresponding element of A. So I'd have to write a for loop to do it, whereas with structs, I can actually just do the assignment. Okay, well, it's after 10, so we'll stop here, and we'll pick up with structs tomorrow.